Blog Talk Radio.
WPR Rebuttal is on the air.
Hello, welcome to WPR Rebuttal. I'm your host, Senator JPO. And today we are talking about Joel Oehler's return to the question and answer website, Quora. And he'll be on that site with a whole bunch of questions on Monday, November 7th, 2016. I have to, of course, update the SEO tags to make sure it says November 7th because you know, a lot of important things are happening in early November. And I know to our British listeners, November 5th is Guy Fawkes Day. And for our American listeners, November 8th is U.S. General Election Day. So November 7th is going to be Joel Oehler's last-minute Quora blitz, and he is going to set a record for the number of Quora questions posted by a single user within a 24-hour period. So Mr. Oehler gave us some of the questions. Our listeners, therefore, have a preview of what's going to be posted on Monday. And of course, our number where you can call in and send your own questions to Mr. Oehler that he might post on Quora if they haven't already been posted in similar language or identical topics. You can call in your questions right now at 929-477-3965. So, first of all, I mean, Joel Oehler, why is he on Quora? Well, it just so happens that this is an extension of his mind war, so to speak, against the abuses and exploitations of higher education. He wants to make sure that as many people in the general public are well informed about the hazards of higher education. And being a question and answer website, Quora is an ideal avenue for dissemination of these ideas that might not necessarily be promoted on campus because they would be perceived as subversive to the very institution where free exchange of ideas is supposed to occur. So by not being linked to any particular university, Quora is potentially a greater marketplace of ideas where even if highly paid people, the administrators, if they don't like it, then there's nothing they can do about taking it off Quora. They cannot just flag it and say, hey, I disagree, take it off. We'll not have that on our website because the university does not own Quora. Board of Regents does not own Quora. So although it's not a good website if you're trying to stump for people to buy your consulting services, it is a good website if you're looking to spread some propaganda. If you're looking to win the mind war by spreading free information to counteract all the public relations tactics to countervail the propaganda of the higher education hucksters. So on to the questions. And again, if you, dear listeners, have any questions that you want considered to be put onto the website Quora, but you don't want to bother making your own account and posting it yourself, what you can do is you can actually propose some to Joel Oehler because he is going to be posting over 100 questions on Monday, November 7th. So here's our call-in number at WPR Rebuttal. It's 929-477-3965. And some of the interesting questions Mr. Oehler has given us a preview of are, the staffing agency workers wanted to unionize. Would they need to collect signatures from all temporary employees assigned work through that branch? Or would they only need to unionize the temps sent to a particular worksite? Okay, so the idea of this is actually separate from the joint labor ruling from the Department of Labor. A joint labor ruling merely says that if the workers were unionized, then both the staffing agency and the client employer purchasing the workers from the agency or leasing them, so to speak, they would both be responsible for meeting the demands of the union, just like they're both responsible for paying workers' compensation, although, of course, they need particular agreements about that. But the bottom line is that they're both paying payroll taxes. They're both contributing to workers' compensation and unemployment benefits funds. Now, Mr. Oler's question, as he formulated it, is that the staffing agency employees want to unionize. And what I mean, what Mr. Oler means by that is that he's not talking about the actual white-collar employees who assign the work, or rather who match the temps to opportunities. What he is actually talking about are the temps who are assigned work. Would they need to unionize every single one of them across the different job sites in order to get that one agency unionized, or could they just do a partial unionization where only the workers at the agency who are at one work site, if they can get unionized, and the other workers who don't unionize at the other job sites, would they be balkanized and just, it would of course have to be an open shop, because if you unionize part of the agency's workers and the rest under a closed shop rule, they would need to unionize, is my understanding. But again, that's why Joel is going to put that question on Quora, that others with experience in that silo of human resources and that function of labor bargaining, the collective bargaining, that is, they can weigh in as to the logistics. Now here's another one. What are some personality deficiencies that prevent the job interviewee from being offered a job? Now, Mr. Oler says, presume the person in question already meets the following requisites. Has a resume reflecting a steady work history that also demonstrates relevant skills for a job desired. Is appropriately dressed and groomed for a job interview. In other words, has neither odor nor strong fragrance. And has a list of former supervisors and character references, including a social security card in case a job is offered that day. Okay, so that pretty much covers all non-personality variables. But what are the personality attributes that can cost someone a job? And really, because they're so-called intangible qualities, right? It's difficult to measure that, and if it's difficult to measure, then it's difficult to monitor it and improve it before the damage is done. And even after the fallout of a job rejection, hiring managers are not going to tell you what you can improve about your personality. It's just unfortunate, but no, so it's a big secret, and that's why Joel is putting that question on Quora to go and do his best to expose the underlying factors of that. Oh, man. Going through this list of our questions. Man, he sent us a whole bunch, and he has these queued up for Monday, November 7th, because, I mean, he would post them sooner, but he is working all weekend. So, here's a good one. Why don't urban protesters focus their efforts on human resources staff as opposed to just the general public? Now, I feel that's a really good question, because really, the general public is not going to have opportunities to go and change policies overnight. Whereas human resource people, within a week or so, they could potentially offer you a job if you're protesting for like more opportunity or other things like that. Yeah, those three good human resources definitely have the greatest ability to go and offer you a position by which you can better support yourself. But no, generally the protesters avoid harassing human resource people, and I'm not too sure why that is, but in his explanation, Joeler says that it would drive home the point that is the collective decisions of people in human resources that most directly contribute to unemployment or to the joblessness of those who want to work in higher skilled roles, but it's precisely because protesting HR policies would involve protesting in residential areas as opposed to those commercial thoroughfares that are designated for protesting. So those who protest the human resource people at their homes or at their place of employment, they're at the greatest risk of punishment. So it boils down to just getting enough people where the anonymity of the crowd would provide some insulation from allegations of harassment. Yeah, hard questions here. Your question of, did dentists sell wisdom teeth? When wisdom teeth are extracted, did a dentist sell them to people or organizations that want to process the teeth to harvest stem cells? And that's a very interesting proposition. Teeth do contain stem cells, but yeah, why is it that dentists don't really offer the option of the patient keeping his or her extracted teeth, whether wisdom teeth or otherwise? But yeah, isn't that true where dentists generally throw out the teeth as soon as possible instead of like let them linger for the patient to look at or keep and take home? Yeah, it's kind of fishy that they would just want to get rid of the teeth really quickly. I mean, it's not like the patient is going to stab himself or herself with the roots of the tooth. So it's not really a sharp in the literal sense, although I guess technically it's medical waste and a sharp, but really some might want to take them home as trophies. But again, unless they make it a real concerted effort to tell a dentist in advance, hey, I want to take these home, I mean, they're not going to be afforded the opportunity, and a dentist will just throw them away before a patient wakes up from the surgery. And yeah, of course, that would give the appearance of hoarding the teeth that they can be sold for people who want to harvest the stem cells from those extracted teeth. That's a very good question posed by Mr. Rowland. Oh, here's another subversive question. Why would rich men ever marry if they want to retain their wealth? Okay, so Joeler writes, premise one, wealthy men enjoy being rich. They measure their own self-worth by their financial wealth. But above all, they want to remain rich. Premise two, marriage represents enormous financial risk. Not so much for how much one spouse might spend, like in a separate or non-joint account, but for how much a divorce settlement might potentially award that former spouse. And according to CNN Money, these divorce settlements can be in the billions. So the conclusion that Joeler says, rich men who want to preserve their wealth should not marry because that is the only way to prevent the divorce settlement. Because even in a no-fault state, or a state with no fault divorce, there might be joint property or even a prenuptial agreement. Again, it's very difficult to circumvent the joint property provisions. I know Wisconsin is a joint property state, so if you're a rich guy in Wisconsin and you want to keep your wealth, don't marry. Don't marry because then half your stuff will automatically be your spouse's. So just avoid marriage if you want to hold on to your money. Okay, here's another question from Joeler. Why do some people equate police monitoring of polling sites with voter intimidation? I mean, after all, law enforcement is there to uphold the law and make sure that civilians are not harassing each other or anything like that. And if police are harassing civilians, then they can definitely file citizens' complaints. And it's just one of those things. I'm tired. Holy cow. Okay, so continuing that voter intimidation question. Joeler says, police have an incentive to interrogate voters only if suspicion of a crime arises, and these situations might be an attempted vote violates the procedure, such as when the same-day registrant cannot provide proof of residence, but still refuse to leave the polling site until allowed to vote. Or a properly registered voter had done early voting in another district, but then, that would be at least 11 days prior, right? And then at least within the past 10 days moved to another voting district and voted again. Hey, that's possible, especially if you rent an apartment and you have enough money where you can rent concurrently in different districts. Yeah, that type of double voting via different districts, that type of fraud is definitely possible, even though it's not easily caught. Okay, so here's another question. Oh, great. Well, yeah, great question from Joel. What is the difference between social justice and socialism? Yeah, let's let the higher education hucksters and the apparatchiks try to explain that one. Moving on. How can an economic impact analysis be independently verified without listing the methodology of that analysis? Oh, yeah. This is Joel Oler's dig against David Ward and his North Star Economics. The problem with North Star Economics is that they usually do not explain their methodology. So when they talk about alleged billion-dollar impacts of UW-Madison or wherever, it really seems like North Star just pulled numbers out of their carcass, because how can anyone independently verify these numbers when David Ward and his other analysts do not explain how they arrived at their data sets? What was their sampling methodology? How do they define what the attribute to UW-Madison and what was from geographically adjacent organizations not affiliated with UW-Madison, such as anything involving tourism? And how do they equate UW-Madison receiving certain grants with other Wisconsin organizations who had applied for those grants, but they didn't get it because UW-Madison got them first, right? I mean, either way, the grant would have gone to some Wisconsin organization in certain situations. Okay, so going down the rest of the questions. Oh, here's a thorny one. Why doesn't the immigration debate focus upon improving working conditions, the agricultural, construction, and hospitality jobs, to make those types of work more appealing to citizens already in the United States to reduce reliance upon migrant labor? Yeah, that's a really good question. And Joeler has a lot of details in this. I'll just let him write it out on Monday. It's really, really complicated. Okay, is the skills gap more of a matter of overeducated people having to settle for lower skill jobs? Another great question. Going down the list. Do certain architectural elements correspond with particular personality traits? Well, I guess that'd be depend mostly on the culture, but still, that's a good question. Because, you know, for stuff where you can't just Google an answer, that's what CORE is all about. To get more experiential-based answers where there's not really a fixed answer that's definitively correct. It depends mostly upon more or less a public consensus within each subculture. So different people from different subcultures will give different answers for stuff, for questions that are more or less glorified projective tests, such as, well, what type of personality do you give to this type of architecture style? How fair is the United Nations process for declaring a rogue state? Oh, another awesome question. More questions. Why are Western governments obsessed with keeping banks profitable? Oh, yes. Yes, well, really, I mean, with the modern means of exchange, it's possible where people can just use credit unions and online financial services such as PayPal. PayPal is now a bank. So really, I mean, people can go and use alternatives to banks such that it's only like the really big corporations that rely on investment banking, but they shouldn't, because really a good business does not need investment banking in order to remain solvent. A good business will have adequate cash flow from satisfied customers. So really, the banks should be able to collapse without harming society. Yeah, why are Western governments obsessed with keeping banks profitable? Heck, I mean, the banks are being bad, i.e. investing non-investment customers' residential deposits into stuff that amounts to gambling, then yeah, just close down those banks. Artsy-fartsy stuff. Not artsy-fartsy, but this question is, why did T.S. Eliot believe April was the cruelest month? Now, Joel Oler tells us that he formulated that question because he was looking at different crossword clues, and he found one that said, the cruelest month according to T.S. Eliot. And when he solved the puzzle, the solution turned out to be April. And really, speaking only for myself, I mean, April has not been that bad for me personally, but I can see where maybe T.S. Eliot believed that April was the cruelest month because that is when federal income taxes are due. And usually the state income tax is due, but definitely federal income tax deadline is April 15th in the United States. But I never had any problem with that. I file on time, and I usually get a refund. Here's another one. Why does Western society continue to value parenthood as a measure of success? Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people's legacies now are more ideological in thought leadership rather than anything biological, more than any type of wealth transfer. So I can see the merit of that question. Okay. Still going through some more questions here. Looks like we might have covered most of them, but I'm going through this big document here. And, oh, yeah, okay, here's another great one. Why does Saudi Arabia want to transition from its oil economy? Well, the official story is that oil reserves are running out, but really, I presume technology will exist in the near future where we won't even have to drill for oil anymore. We will be able to synthesize oil, or at least multiply the oil we have by just taking a sample and then, like, spraying it out. I mean, kind of similar to how we already do with ethanol for gasoline, but with our petroleum products, we can do a similar derivative where we have synthetic oil or synthetic petroleum products, and thereby spread out how many how much product volume we can make with the same quantity of starting petroleum. Okay, why do cities ask for job candidates prior salaries when hiring for municipal manager? That's a very good one, because really that can definitely be discriminatory, not just in terms of like never letting inexperienced people have a crack at municipal manager, but also against lines of class, which I guess classism is lawful under EEO laws, but to the extent that class differences are comorbid with race and gender, then that can become unlawful in terms of disparate impact. But again, it just takes a lot of careful documentation to prove that. But yeah, as a public administration major who never was admitted to the field, I definitely don't like it when cities ask for prior salaries, because really that means that if you have been stuck in food service and manual labor, I'll never give you an interview for municipal manager because your salary is too low, even if you purport to have the skills to be a municipal manager from internships and whatnot. Just the low or non-existent salary and internship practically guarantees you won't be taken seriously as a candidate for municipal manager. So, yeah, that's definitely a bad practice, and kudos to Joel Ohler for asking that question. Oh, here's another interesting question. How did humans evolve so many languages? Yeah. Okay, so if forming a civilization was adaptive from an evolutionary perspective, and if having different languages divides us into different civilizations, okay, as opposed to unifying us, then why did humans evolve so many languages? It would make more sense if we evolved a single language, but again, with the whole contradictory thing where we are supposed to evolve from the same general cradle of civilization, right? Some say it's in Mesopotamia, others will say it's in North Africa, but the bottom line is that we're supposed to evolve from one spot, and apparently we did not evolve language until we spread out in a diaspora, and then apparently these other people on these different continents and develop their own languages. But it doesn't explain why we evolved so many, because really, if civilization were adaptive, then we would be living together sooner, and our proximity would have us use more of the same language instead of different languages. So, yeah. And again, that's a situation where a Tower of Babel story from Chapter 11 of Genesis might potentially make more sense than evolutionary theory of diverse languages. Okay, so here's another one. It's looking at our time here, how much time we have. Okay, we have about 2 minutes left, so. Oh, here's an incisive question. What is the difference between a hedge fund manager and a street gambler? Yeah, well, a hedge fund manager is paid handsomely to work in an office, because, you know, the organization he works for legitimizes gambling, where a street gambler is usually just a solo operation without any powerful organization to legitimize his gambling. Okay, so other questions? Why do analysts equate market withdrawals with wealth destruction? Yeah, just because you can't necessarily measure or track the wealth doesn't mean that it's been destroyed. It just means that it's hidden. That's all. Well, again, if you want more questions, just go to Joel Ohler's core profile. And our next episode of WPR Rebuttal is going to be 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah. No, actually, it's going to be the 11th. Because, yeah, 4 plus 7 is 11. So that would be Friday, November 11th at around 1:30. So I will see everyone then. In the meantime, if you want to email us any information, our email address is feedback@wpr-rebuttal.com. Okay, see you in about a week. Bye.